Before we get to the show, an announcement. When you make a gift to the world, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. And thanks for your support. The impeachment inquiry kept rolling today. The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine recounts being called bad news in a presidential tweet.
It was a terrible moment. The person who saw me actually reading the transcript said that the color drained from my face. I think I even had a physical reaction.
And chasing Joe Biden and conspiracy theories in Ukraine.
As far as I am aware, unless the Republicans have uncovered something new recently, there is no evidence of that wrongdoing.
Also today... theme song for Sesame Street in Germany. The iconic children's show turns 50 this weekend. It's been broadcast in 150 nations, soft power, Cookie Monster style. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. And on the second day...
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Today at the public impeachment inquiry in Washington, we heard from Marie Masha Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Yovanovitch was the target of a smear campaign led by President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. She was accused of trying to thwart anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. The State Department called it a classic disinformation campaign. Still in May, Yovanovitch was removed from her post by Trump after more than three decades in the Foreign Service. Yovanovitch spoke today in personal terms about her fear of being targeted by the president of the United States. Yovanovitch said she was shocked and devastated by the way Trump spoke about her on that July phone call to Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
President Trump said that I was bad news to another world leader and that I would be going through some things. It was a terrible moment. A person who saw me actually reading the transcript said that the color drained from my face. I think I even had a physical reaction.
Then, a surreal moment, but not a surprising one for these times, Trump entered the conversation in real time. Democrat Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, informed Yovanovitch that the president was sounding off during the hearing.
As we sit here testifying, the president is attacking you on Twitter. And I'd like to give you a chance to respond. I'll read part of one of his tweets. Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go?
Well, I don't think I have such powers, not in Mogadishu, Somalia, not in other places. I actually think that where I've served over the years, I and others have demonstrably made things better, you know, for the U.S. as well as for the countries that I've served in.
The president implicitly threatened you in that call record. And now the president in real time is attacking you. What effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
Chairman Schiff went on to say that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously. Another major thread in today's testimony, the undermining of career diplomats. Here's Yovanovitch again.
The State Department is being hollowed out from within at a competitive and complex time on the world stage. This is not a time to undercut our diplomats.
Molly Montgomery is a former advisor to Vice President Mike Pence on Europe and Eurasia. She spent 14 years in the Foreign Service before stepping down last year. Molly, you've been listening today to Marie Yovanovitch, like a lot of people. What's jumped out at you?
Absolutely. Well, first off, let me just say that Ambassador Yovanovitch is a profile in courage. And I think what comes across so clearly in her testimony today is just what the United States is missing out on by sidelining its career officials.
What do you think the long-term consequences are for U.S. diplomacy of her testimony?
Well, it certainly has made clear to the American people and to the world that our foreign policy and the State Department are in shambles. And I don't think you have to look any further than the way she has been treated and others in the State Department have been treated to understand why. I fully agree with her characterization that the department has been hollowed out. And unfortunately, diplomacy is a craft that takes years, if not decades, to learn. And so that expertise will not be able to be replaced quickly or easily. It's a real loss to us.
I mean, Yovanovitch was talking about visceral stuff today, her fear after just seeing the transcript of what Donald Trump said about her. What were you, as a career Foreign Service officer, what were you feeling listening to her testimony?
There are a lot of us who have served the country in various capacities who I think were very emotional in hearing her speak about how it has felt to undergo the traumatic experience of being targeted by her own president and pulled from an assignment in which, by all accounts, she was succeeding. And so it is very troubling, particularly having seen the president's tweet while her testimony was ongoing, to see from the Oval Office the targeting of career officials and questioning of the quality of their work and their patriotism. It is very scary for people who go to and from work every day, just like you and I do, don't have any special protection and find themselves very vulnerable, not just to trolls online, but, you know, to anyone who might choose to take those words as an inspiration to do harm.
Also this week, Molly, you were watching closely for the release of a report from the State Department's Inspector General, one case in particular, that of a career department official and Iran expert named Sahar Nouruzadeh. What did the State Department's watchdog find?
Sahar was an Iran expert who had served as almost all public servants do for the previous administration. And her national origin is Iranian. And so there was a very troubling, I think, implication that her loyalty was suspect, both because of her work for the Obama administration, as well as her background. The report concluded that, in fact, she had been mistreated and that there were high-level officials, including the current envoy for Iran, Brian Hook, who was at the time the director of policy planning, who had, based on not on merit, but on these other reasons, sidelined her from her duties and had her reassigned.
So this sounds familiar. Do you see parallels with what we're hearing happen to U.S. career diplomats in Ukraine? I mean, is that fair?
So absolutely. I would say that we have seen a number of cases, not just in Sahar's case or in Ukraine, of career officials who have been targeted based on either their work, or we have seen this idea of questioning the loyalty, particularly of public servants who are immigrants, both Marie Yovanovitch, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who testified or was deposed by the House impeachment inquiry recently, have seen their loyalty questioned because they immigrated to the United States, which is really disturbing, I think, to those of us who have served alongside people like Masha and understand that their patriotism comes, if anything, from a deeper place, because of having experienced other systems that don't have the freedoms and the values that the United States has.
Molly Montgomery, a former advisor to Vice President Mike Pence on Europe and Eurasia. She spent 14 years in the Foreign Service before stepping down last year. Molly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Adams, our nation's second president, once famously said, "Facts are stubborn things." Right now, Republicans and Democrats are trading allegations over corruption, abuse of power, and foreign election meddling. You could say our job as journalists is to present both sides, and we do. But if one person says it's rainy and somebody else says it's sunny, it's our job to look out the window. And right now, the Republican Party is putting forth several allegations without evidence to back them up. Take Devin Nunes, ranking Republican member on the House Intelligence Committee, speaking this morning about his Democratic colleagues at the impeachment inquiry.
They are blind to the blaring signs of corruption surrounding Hunter Biden's well-paid position on the board of a corrupt Ukrainian company while his father served as vice president and point man for Ukraine issues in the Obama administration.
Nina Jankowicz has the interesting title of Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington. So, Nina, let's focus on this one story about the Bidens in Ukraine. Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, he had a paid position on the board of Ukrainian energy company Burisma. Vice President Joe Biden did help push for the dismissal of a Ukrainian prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, in 2015. Those are the facts. So explain for us what the GOP actually alleges to be the wrongdoing by the Bidens in Ukraine.
Well, the Republicans are alleging that Vice President Biden lobbied for the firing of Viktor Shokin in order to protect his son from prosecution. But in reality, as we heard the Democratic counsel lay out today during the impeachment hearing with Marie Yovanovitch, this firing of Viktor Shokin actually made Hunter Biden and all of Burisma more likely to be prosecuted, not less.
And what evidence is there to support the allegation of wrongdoing by the Bidens in Ukraine?
As far as I am aware, unless the Republicans have uncovered something new recently, there is no evidence of that wrongdoing. There seems to have been a firewall between Hunter Biden and his father, who had, as you said, been the point person on Ukraine. And actually, as someone who advised the Ukrainian government under the auspices of a Fulbright fellowship at the end of the Obama administration, I can tell you that he was seen, this is Joe Biden, the vice president, was seen as, you know, a shining star, a real advocate for anti-corruption reform in Ukraine, an advocate for Ukraine's democratic future. He wasn't seen as someone who was bullying the president or anyone else in the Ukrainian administration to do corrupt things. It was the opposite.
Of course, the whole Biden-Ukraine issue was brought up by President Trump in that now famous phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart on July 25th. Is there any chance that evidence could yet be uncovered?
I don't think that there will be any evidence uncovered about this alleged corruption because, as far as we know, it didn't exist. The anti-corruption protesters and activists in Ukraine were also lobbying for Viktor Shokin, that prosecutor general, to be removed from office. He was a corrupt figure who was stalling anti-corruption reform in Ukraine. And this is a conspiracy theory in order to get dirt on the Bidens in a very politically charged atmosphere at the expense of Ukraine.
So there you are, Nina, at the Wilson Center as the disinformation fellow. You called this a conspiracy theory. Why do you see it as a conspiracy theory? What defines that?
Well, you know, this is something that a bunch of people are working together to push false information in order to dupe the American public into thinking that a major politician is guilty of some sort of wrongdoing. And of course, this all rolls into some other theories and narratives about Ukraine, that Ukraine colluded with the Democrats in order to throw the 2016 election for Trump. There is no evidence of that. And it seems that Rudy Giuliani and several Ukrainians have been involved in pushing those conspiracy theories.
It's not just Rudy Giuliani, though. I mean, the Biden-Ukraine story just keeps getting wheeled out. It's getting a lot of exposure and repeated. Why?
It fits in this convenient narrative that Russia is not to be blamed for the interference in the 2016 election that may have contributed to Donald Trump's election, that it's the Democrats and Ukraine to blame. And actually, who is the ultimate beneficiary of all of these narratives? It's the Kremlin.
What is the chain of custody of the Biden-Ukraine story? Where did it start? Who picked it up? And how did it get circulated?
Well, it seems that there are several Ukrainians who planted this story in the media. One of them is another prosecutor general. There are many in this story, Yuri Lutsenko, who kind of had a bone to pick with Ambassador Yovanovitch. She had been a tough critic of his, a tough critic of his lack of work on anti-corruption reform. And I think he saw her and the potential election of Zelensky as an impediment to his future in government. So he was trying to shore up his alliance as the new administration was coming into power. And by planting this narrative against the ambassador about the Bidens, it was a sure way to get Trump administration officials on his side.
Nina Jankowicz, the disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington. Thank you very much for this.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
You're with the world. Hey there, listener. We have some exciting news. The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for independent, nonprofit journalism. When you make a gift to The World, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. Every day, we bring you in-depth stories from around the world that make you a more informed global citizen. You value the high-quality journalism you hear on The World. So make a gift to support it today at theworld.org/match. And thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The longest and furthest passenger flight ever landed in Sydney, Australia, earlier today. It had flown nonstop from London, 19 hours in the air. It was a test flight run by the airline Qantas to research the feasibility of ultra-long-haul routes and the impact on passengers and crew. The BBC's Luke Jones was on board.
Good morning again, everyone. This is the captain. Welcome aboard this very special flight from London to Sydney.
The first London to Sydney flight, almost 100 years ago to the day, took 28 days.
So without further ado, the planned flying time of 19 hours and 17 minutes looks like we'll be touching down in Sydney at approximately...
This double sunset flight is considerably quicker.
Hold on a seat so you don't lose your balance, and you're going to try to reach your foot.
There's only 50 of us on board to make this huge jet light enough to get there, and we're all guinea pigs. Researchers want to know what ultra-long haul does to those in cabin and cockpit.
So I'm Corinne Cayo, Associate Professor at the University of Sydney. We have designed with the team the timing of the light and the timing as well of the meals and composition of the meals as well, and the exercise and the timing of the exercise. Okay, right, so now what we're going to do, we're going to do a bit of stretching of the quadriceps.
I find one of the passengers being tested on, a frequent flyer chosen especially for this flight.
And so we fill in a mood.
On an iPad, we do the alertness test that she has to do. A number appears on the screen and quickly counts upwards. You've got to tap it as soon as possible. Ooh, 380, is that good?
No, I've had 100s. I might be jet-lagged.
300, you're jet-lagged. You're rubbish.
Okay, I'm going to cancel this one.
Today, as we've departed London in the wee small hours of darkness, the first of our two sunrises is just about to occur on the horizon to our east now.
Sleep time, dark time, is quite strictly enforced, and light monitors on wrists and clothing are going to let the researchers know whether all of this worked. All of this is basically to avoid jet lag, which... if you get it, isn't the end of the world. Personally, I'm a lot more worried about how well-rested the pilot is. Dr. Tracy Sletten from Monash University is testing them. So what's this? This is like a headset. It looks like sunglasses, but without the glasses bit.
That's right. So this is what we call an EEG. It stands for an electroencephalogram. And basically, it's got some dry electrodes that are really tapping into our brain activity. And so we're able to see, while they're awake, just how alert they are at different times based on the different brain patterns that we can see.
These flights aren't even commercially possible yet. They haven't got the planes that could travel the full distance with a full load of passengers, and there are many regulations still in place stopping staff and crew from working so long. But their hope is that this research on this flight will show that it is safe and that that will help lower some of the many hurdles.
The BBC's own guinea pig, Luke Jones, reporting there from, about 35,000 feet up in the sky. You won't need electrodes for the trip we're about to take to the Alfama neighborhood in Lisbon, Portugal.
My name is Carminho, is Maria do Carmo de Carvalho Rebelo de Andrade. It's a big name.
A long name, but everyone in Portugal knows her simply as Carminho, an exceptional singer of the Portuguese style known as fado.
Quem escreve suas canções, dizendo aquilo que sente, faz crescer os corações, emoções como semente.
As a fadista, Carminho is a big star in Portugal. Several years ago, before she became big, she was at university studying marketing and singing in fado clubs to make money. But something was missing in her life.
I was not happy with that. I was not happy with the marketing and publicity. I didn't know that I could be a professional singer. I just sang normally like a hobby. I already sang in fado houses. And I had some companies, big companies, to invite me to make an album with them. And I was very scared because I was sure that I didn't have the maturity to make an album, to defend the album. So I, with the money I earned from singing in fado houses, I bought a ticket to a round world travel. And I was 1 year backpacking and doing volunteer work and doing, and learning more about myself than any time before. And still I have a lot of fruits from that experience.
And the kind of work you were doing, I mean, you spent 2 months, as I said, at Mother Teresa's mission in Calcutta. Was the volunteer work you were doing generally kind of for poor people?
I was with the people who is going to die, was going to die soon. They are very sick. And then I worked also with the handicapped children, and was a beautiful work too. Agora entendo a canção que eu vi uma vida inteira. I didn't sing during the trip because I wanted to discover if I really wanted to sing. So I quit to sing. Even to when you go travel alone, what you heard mostly is people asking you, who are you? And I was able to choose whatever I wanted. So I could choose to say, I'm a ballerina, I'm a lawyer, or I'm a singer, because In my town in Lisbon, nobody wanted to see to listen fado when I was young, so I get a little bit sad, and it was not so good to say to people I was a fadista because nobody cared. My friends didn't like it. When I was in traveling, I decided to what I'm gonna do, put myself on. In this situation again, and people saying that, oh, what is that? But I was surprised because I started to say that I was singing a traditional song from my country, and I was a singer, and people was so enthusiastic and so joy, with a lot of joy to know more about the culture, about myself, about what I was doing in Portugal, that I get a lot of confidence, more confidence to embrace this culture and to return and to sing again. So I think my voice changed too, and my confidence changed, and my knowledge, more knowledge to understand the words, because fado, it's about music, but it's also about lyrics and poems and the words, the energy you put in each word. It's so important to the final result. Não pensem que me esqueci. De
começar a fiar. So you've got a few more concerts left. What is the best way to listen to fado, a music with lyrics in Portuguese that many Americans do not understand? What's your advice to Americans?
I advise them to open their hearts and to see if they can connect with their history, because the histories of fado, it's all about feelings. It's all about love and taking care and missing someone. So there's something magical in fado that when you put the truth on each word, the audience, even they don't understand the words, they can get some of the energy and can get something to them. No velo que por quebrar
deu a ideia. Portuguese fado singer Carminho. Now that you know how to listen to fado, you can hear her live. Carminho has 3 more dates on her U.S. tour. Los Angeles tomorrow, San Francisco on Sunday, and she's in Washington, D.C. next Tuesday. A young American-Israeli woman sits in a Russian prison. She was carrying a small amount of marijuana while passing through the Moscow airport. That usually gets a light sentence.
So why was my sister sentenced to 7.5 years? Where's the justice here? Where does this make any sense?
Her family thinks it's about politics. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI and PRX. Today, it was the turn to speak publicly for former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Congress heard her testimony at the impeachment hearings.
Ukraine, with an enormous landmass and a large population, has the potential to be a significant commercial and political partner for the United States, as well as a force multiplier on the security side. We see the potential in Ukraine. Russia, by contrast, sees the risk. The history is not written yet, but Ukraine could move out of Russia's orbit.
That's the news of the day from Washington. Gustav Gressel is the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations' Wider Europe program. He's also a former official with the Austrian Ministry of Defense. He joins us from Kyiv. Listening to Ambassador Yovanovitch there, Mr. Gressel, do you think the European Union would have a similar assessment of Ukraine?
Yes, quite. The EU would have a similar assessment. For the EU, one additional moment comes in, that is, Ukraine is a neighbor. It has borders with Romania, with Hungary, with Slovakia, and with Poland. And the cross-border relations have intensified. Ukraine actually has a very long history of forging ties with the EU. Sometimes these ties were more successful than the others. And for the Ukrainians, the European Union is also a focal point of their own aspiration to become a functional democracy and a rule of law-based society. And all these aspirations basically galvanized in a Maidan upspring against the corrupt government under then-President Yanukovych.
Right, that goes back to 2014. Generally, it sounds like Europe is simpatico to Ukraine's desire to lean into the West and wants to help underwrite that. So I'm curious to know, how has Europe viewed President Trump's Ukraine scandal and the impeachment hearings?
Well, there is great concern about the Ukraine policy of Trump. I have to say that there are a few countries in the world where American foreign policy and European foreign policy was as well coordinated as with Ukraine. In many cases, for example, Ukrainian officials and American officials work together within the same project. There are many programs that are funded by the EU but executed by the Americans. And this is seen as being at risk now. Mm. The Americans had, because of their status, because of their power, because of their engagement in the military field, always had a special place in Ukraine, and they were very useful to bring forward key anti-corruption reforms and legislative issues that they pushed for. That, of course, now is gone. Also, the picture that the scandal sent to Ukrainian officials is bad, because it's basically the prime Western power that is engaged in a kind of abusive power and corruption scheme on its own. It's a bad thing. The president, of course, tries to keep it out of Ukrainian politics. He needs the American support for the reform of the armed forces. He also needs American support with regard to Russia. So he can't confront Trump or say anything negative. On the other hand, he tries to minimize the spillover of this scandal into Ukrainian politics.
With the U.S. partnership, though, with Ukraine shaken by the allegations that are now kind of coursing through the impeachment inquiry, one can imagine Ukraine looking for support from non-American partners. Is the EU ready to step in as Ukraine continues to face Russian aggression in the East?
On the economic and the financial field, there is readiness of the EU to step up. It will be very difficult in the military field, because some member states want the EU out of this business. And even for those member states who have sympathy or engage with the Ukrainian military, they are not so big as the U.S. Army. They don't have the same resources. They don't have the same defense industrial sector. Trainers from, I don't know, Lithuania or from Poland in a Ukrainian base, or if they're American trainers there, it sends a different message to Russia. And in this field, the United States are pretty much irreplaceable.
Gustav Gressel, the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations Wider Europe program, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
A 26-year-old woman with both Israeli and American citizenship sits in a Russian prison. Nama Issachar was convicted of smuggling narcotics. She was flying from India to Israel and had a layover in Moscow. Issachar's sentenced for transporting marijuana, 7.5 years behind bars. Her family is convinced that she's caught in a diplomatic standoff, a bargaining chip to get a Russian hacker released from a prison in Israel. But the hacker was extradited to the U.S. this week, so now Issachar's family worries that there's no longer any leverage to shorten her sentence. Her sister, Liad Goldberg, lives in Los Angeles. Liad, when was the last time you spoke with your sister? Have you had a chance to speak with Nama since she was first arrested?
The last time I spoke to her was in August, when I went to Moscow for one of the hearings that she had before her sentencing. And I saw her once in prison, and then once in the courtroom. But both times I wasn't able to hug her or touch her or anything.
From that distance, how did she seem?
I mean, she's not good. She tries to be as optimistic as possible and to, you know, to remain hopeful. But, you know, I could see it in her eyes and in her energy that she's tired. I mean, to say that she's over it is such an understatement. But, you know, she's languishing in a prison.
Yeah. I gather your mother is in Moscow. Has she been able to visit Nama?
My mom is able to see her. They only allow visitations twice a month. They make things a lot harder on my sister than they do on the other prisoners because of the language barrier. Mm. They don't let her make phone calls. They don't, when my mother goes to see her, they can't speak Hebrew. They have to speak English, and there needs to be a guard there, you know, listening to what they're saying. It's really insane.
Have either U.S. or Israeli embassy officials been helpful?
Yeah, the Israeli government is very, very involved. The prime minister and his office, you know, they've promised to do everything they can to get Nama out. And they are constantly working on plans or negotiations or what they do behind closed doors to try and get her out.
So are you planning to travel back to Moscow to visit her?
I want to, but to be honest, I'm terrified. It's a really scary situation, what happened to my sister, and what happened to her can literally happen to any person traveling to or through Moscow. I mean, I would love to go, but I'm honestly very, very scared that something will happen to me as well.
If I understand the details correctly, your sister was found to have less than a third of an ounce of marijuana on her when she was arrested. I mean, typically, doesn't that get a slap on the wrist in Russia?
Well, it should have been a possession charge, which is where you're imprisoned for up to 1 month, you pay a fine, and then you're deported out of the country. And to give a great example, there was a student from Staten Island, Audrey Lorber was her name, I believe, and she got caught in St. Petersburg with 19 grams of weed that she brought in from the United States. And I believe after 7 weeks and a small fine, she was sent back home. So why was my sister, who had 9 grams, sentenced to 7.5 years? Where's the justice here? Where does this make any sense? This is how we know it's more than just the drugs.
What do you think it could be if it's not just the drugs?
It's clearly they're holding her for political reasons. They're trying to, you know, we believe that they were trying to use my sister as an exchange for the Russian hacker Alexei Berkov, but he has already been extradited to the United States. So that is no longer an option for Russia, and I believe they're quite upset about it.
So, Liad, as to Alexei Berkov, the Russian hacker who he'd been in an Israeli prison, and initially your family petitioned against extraditing him to Russia, the Israeli government requested that you drop that petition, which you did. Now Berkov, as you said, he's been extradited to the U.S. So what's next for you? Have you heard anything from the Kremlin at this point?
We are hoping that, you know, Bibi Netanyahu, he asked for a pardon for my sister, and we are hoping that President Putin will eventually agree to this pardon. It's really all in his hands. It's really all in President Putin's hands, and we're just hopeful that the Israeli government will continue to be able to convince him to release my sister, especially now that Berkov is no longer on the table for my sister to be used as a bargaining chip. But we do have faith that and trust that Israel will get her out of there.
Liad Goldberg in Los Angeles speaking with us about her sister, Nama Issachar, who is in prison in Russia right now. Thank you very much, Liad. Good luck.
Thank you. Thanks.
Today's episode of The World is brought to you by the number 50. Actually, this week 50 is a number of years Sesame Street has been around, so happy birthday.
Sunny day, sweeping the clouds away.
The show revolutionized children's television in the U.S., but it's not just an American phenomenon. Sesame Street has aired in most countries in the world over the years, and Sesame Workshop has created 30 international co-productions. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum with a look at one of them.
One of the latest places to get Sesame Street is Afghanistan. Bache Simpson, which means Sesame Garden, is not just American Sesame Street dubbed into local languages. It has its own writers and producers, it has its own sets, and it has its own Muppets like Zari.
Salam, dostay aziz! من زری هستم از باغچه سمسم.
A spunky six-year-old who models female empowerment. And it has live-action segments featuring local kids. The show gets funding from the U.S. State Department, and it teaches letters and numbers, but it also advances other international development goals, like girls' education. Think Sesame Street as a form of soft power. This is a live-action segment featuring a Hazara family, which is a persecuted ethnic minority in Afghanistan, and it's called First Day of School. It starts with a little girl. She says, "My name is Zainab and I'm 6 years old." Then Zainab's dad packs her school bag. He kisses her cheeks, showing that the male authority here endorses sending his daughter to school. Then Zainab's parents give her a blessing, showing that Islam also supports the education of women. Anwar Jamili heads an Afghan team that develops content for the show.
Our team responsibility was to bring the Sesame version into Afghan context.
Jamili has been with the show since practically the beginning, and at first he says he was really nervous because most of his writers and producers didn't come from children's programming. A lot of them were reporters or documentary filmmakers.
I was worried because I and my team had the experience of programs for adults, but not for children and particularly preschool age.
So he went to New York to take a class at Sesame Workshop. Jamili learned how to construct a show and promote what you could call Sesame Street's core values: fun, optimism, tolerance. And then he had to go back home and make that work in a conflict zone. This is the approach they decided to take.
It's a positive modeling. We do not talk for the negative modeling.
Meaning no mention of violence, no mention of the Taliban, no mention of ISIS. They focus instead on things like emotional health.
For example, we talk about fear. We talk about disappointment, anger, how to control that, empathy, hope.
But you don't show the violence or you don't reference.
No, we don't show the violence. And we would like to go through positive because that worked.
This is not unique to the Afghan Sesame Street. In the American episode about September 11th, they never talked about terrorism or the Twin Towers. Instead, Elmo sees a grease fire at Hooper's store. Elmo? He's too traumatized to go back in.
Are you all right?
Elmo doesn't want to go back into Hooper's store.
Oh, hey, it's okay. It's okay. There's nothing to be afraid of. The chief said that the fire's out.
Elmo doesn't care, Alan. Elmo doesn't want to go back into Hooper's store.
But then Elmo learns how to process his fear and moves on. This approach, using metaphor and highlighting resilience, works for Anwar Jamili. But he says not everyone on his staff was on board, that some people on his team wanted to address directly what was going on around them.
You know, some of the people, for example, saying that we should talk about the suffer that children have from the fight and from poverty. But then, you know, we also talk that we would like them to be happier. This is the goal.
And it's a good goal. But the approach could also have some drawbacks. Naomi Moland is an anthropologist at American University and the author of Can Big Bird Fight Terrorism? A case study of Sesame Street in Nigeria. She says Sesame Workshop's own research suggests it's important to be direct with kids.
I think one of the main findings is that parents and educators don't talk enough with children about race and poverty and difference and tolerance and religion and all these different things, and that we should be talking with children more explicitly about these topics so that children don't just see these topics as taboo.
But Molin says that can raise another issue because those overt messages are often controversial. Take, for example, Sesame Street in Nigeria.
Saying that we should be friends with Christians if we're Muslims and we should be friends with Muslims if we're Christians. You know, those messages may lead parents or families to believe that the show is trying to push them into some sort of tolerance or coexistence that might not be feasible or tenable given the current conflict in the country.
And that's a dilemma that's unlikely to go away anytime soon, especially in Sesame Workshop's newest international co-productions. one for Syrian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria, and one for Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Northern India is choking. Air pollution returned to critical levels this week. Asta Rungta lives near Delhi with her 9-year-old son and is doing what she can to keep her family safe.
With this kind of pollution outside, unfortunately, we have to keep all the windows and doors shut completely. So no one is allowed to go out even for a minute because we are using the air purifiers. So, you know, I can't allow the outside air to come inside.
Asta is one of many people Divina Gupta spoke with in Delhi for the latest edition of the BBC's Work Life India program. Divina, thanks for being with us. Asta, it seems, is lucky. She's got an air purifier. But I imagine there are many more families without those kind of luxuries. How are they coping?
That's right, Margo. You're talking about 19 million people who are living in Delhi and surrounding areas. I was on the streets earlier this morning and trying to talk to people who can't afford the air purifier, can't afford to protect themselves, and what do they do? So one of the tuk-tuk driver who told me that he just goes about his business through the day. He tries and wrap his face with a cloth when he's around the city. But he says by the end of the day, he's coughing severely. Those who are also on the streets and going about in the buses or walking around, they are just living their lives as if nothing has happened, because they say that we can't really do much about it, and they don't have a mask, they don't have any other alternative but to face it.
Tuk-tuks are those little auto rickshaws, and the drivers basically are exposed to air all day long.
That's right. It's not only them, but even the drivers of the buses or the ride-hailing apps, which are quite popular these days because the city government has ensured a car rationing system, which means that you can only take out your cars on alternative days. So the government here has come out with a policy of distributing free masks, especially to children. And they've also closed school for the second time this week. Earlier this week, I spoke with a high school student, Ayush Bal, about how he's dealing with this high level of pollution.
The number of studies that they're showing us is staying in Delhi is equivalent to smoking 20 cigarettes every day. You really wonder, do you want to stay here? So the input of staying here would decrease, as doctor mentioned, 5 years of my life expectancy if I stay here for another year.
Again, the ability to leave, as that young man was talking about, that's kind of the domain of the wealthy. What are people demanding right now? What is the government actually doing?
So there is graded response action in place right now, in which the construction has stopped. Industries which are seen as polluting industries, like brick manufacturing units, they have been shut. Farmers who've been burning stubble, which is the leftover crop for the next sowing season, which is also adding on to the pollution, have been asked not to do so. In fact, some of them have been even penalized. And this is some sort of a response from the government, which has now declared an air health emergency in Delhi.
As we were getting ready for this interview, Divina, I heard you coughing a little bit. Have you been affected by this, and how are you coping?
Yes, I have been, because my job entails me that I have to go and speak to people. I've been using a mask to protect myself, but it's really difficult to talk to people with that mask. I must say you're at a good spot, Marco, because you're at a place where air quality index, it's around 52 for PM2.5, which are the tiny particulate matter.
Yeah.
And in Delhi, it's 400 times worse.
Wow.
So just imagine if you're in a room which is full of dust and fog, can you breathe? And that's the kind of difficulty that people are facing here.
Divina Gupta is host of the BBC's Work Life India program, speaking with us from Delhi. Divina, thank you very much and take care.
Thank you.
Back now to our top story. The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, testified at the House impeachment inquiry today. Trump pushed the veteran diplomat out of her role as ambassador back in the spring. The World's Matthew Bell was following today's proceedings and is here with me. What is your biggest takeaway here, Matthew?
Yovanovitch is a experienced Foreign Service officer with more than 30 years of experience, a stellar record by all accounts. But suddenly in April, she explained today, the Trump White House decided to remove her as ambassador in Ukraine. And it happened during a late night emergency phone call from Washington. They told her you have to come home immediately because of security concerns. She told the House impeachment investigators today that this came after a smear campaign that was led by Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, picked up by right-wing media outlets. But the point she wanted to make in all this was that This is about more than just her career, she says. Yovanovitch said that this is really about a failure of U.S. foreign policy planning.
How could our system fail like this? How is it that foreign corrupt interests could manipulate our government? Which country's interests are served when the very corrupt behavior we have been criticizing is allowed to prevail? Such conduct undermines the U.S., exposes our friends, and widens the playing field for autocrats like President Putin.
So, Matthew, why did Trump want Yovanovitch gone? And let's remember that it was Yovanovitch that Trump mentioned in the phone call he had with Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Right, the phone call. That was the one on July 25th where Trump, in the call, refers to Yovanovitch as bad news, quote-unquote, said that she was going to go through some things. Today, the Democrats' lawyer, his name is Daniel Goldman, asked Yovanovitch how she felt when she read those words in that transcript from President Trump.
I didn't know what to think, but I was very concerned.
What were you concerned about?
She's going to go through some things. It didn't sound good. Sounded like a threat.
Did you feel threatened?
I did.
So we heard earlier in the show today how President Trump was actually attacking Yovanovitch on Twitter at the same time she was giving her testimony in Congress. Did the Republicans in the inquiry follow the president's tone?
Not really. Many of the Republicans went out of their way to thank the ambassador for her service. They praised her. Ranking member Devin Nunes, though, at one point said that Yovanovitch was actually not, in fact, a material witness, but that her situation at the State Department could have been handled at Human Resources. One thing that Republicans did bring up repeatedly were allegations that Ukraine was meddling in the 2016 election and that Trump was right to be concerned about that. Yovanovitch did not give credence to this storyline. At one point, she reported that U.S. intelligence agencies believe it's Russia that meddled in 2016, not Ukraine. One more thing that Republicans brought up, Hunter Biden's role on the board of that energy company, Burisma. Here's some of what John Ratcliffe from Texas was asking about.
And do you think that that raises a potential concern or conflict of interest that the Vice President of the United States was ordering the firing of the prosecutor in charge of a company that has been identified as one that is substantially corrupt?
I actually don't. I don't think that the view that Mr. Shokin was not a good prosecutor general fighting corruption, I don't think that had anything to do with the Burisma case.
So just to be clear, Yovanovitch saying there that Biden wanted the Ukrainian prosecutor fired precisely because he wasn't fighting corruption.
Thank you very much. The world's Matthew Bell. And that's where we're going to sign off this Friday from the Nana Bill Harris Studio in Boston. We'll see you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.